I have with me in the studio Mr. A.S. Hornby, well known throughout the English teaching world for his extraordinary skill as a lecturer, teacher and writer. Perhaps Mr. Hornby's best known contribution to language teaching is his series of dictionaries, and in particular the Advanced Learner's Dictionary. Mr. Hornby, how did you first become involved in English language teaching?
Oh, I think that started off in 1923, when I was at the University College in London, and after I'd taken my degree, I was asked by the appointments board of the university to meet a young Japanese who was over in London at the time, and he asked whether I would like to go to Japan, to a college in the south, in the island of Kyushu, and teach English. I said, "What do you want me to do?" He says, "Oh, well, you would be teaching English literature, of course, because your degree was in English literature." And it seemed quite an exciting prospect. So I went home to see my mother and father, told them I was going to Japan. Incidentally, I said, "I'm going to get married before I go." They didn't know that. So we got married, and off we went. And I find myself facing classes of 20 to 25 Japanese students, aged about 18, 19, 20, and I found that they were reading English literature quite happily. They were reading Shakespeare, Carlyle, all the classics. And I found that they read with some understanding, and certainly with some appreciation. But whenever I started to talk to them, I found that their knowledge of the English language was very limited indeed. They could read Shakespeare, but then they'd say to me, "Where went you yesterday?" And that kind of thing. So I decided that I must give much more attention to language teaching and leave the teaching of literature to their Japanese professors. And I became more and more fascinated by this question of language and started experimenting. I knew nothing about linguistics at that time. I was only 24 or so. But as time went on, I became familiar with the subject. I read books about it. And then in Tokyo, there was Dr. Harold Palmer, who you must know was a very successful teacher of languages and who wrote many books on the subject of linguistic methodology and grammar. Well, we corresponded, and through my correspondence with him, I became more and more interested in linguistics, especially linguistic methodology. And after a few years in the south of Japan, it was arranged that I should go to a school in Tokyo. And there, I was in the School of Foreign Languages. That was rather like some of the schools in the University of London, you know, School of Oriental Studies, and so on. We had teachers and professors for about 30 or 40 different languages, all the languages of Asia and Europe. And I was in the English department, of course. And then I also had a position in the Tokyo Higher Normal School, and I was concerned with the training of teachers of English. You should take them out to local middle schools and supervise their teaching practice and things of that sort. So I became very much involved there in language teaching. And Palmer, at the same time, was head of the Institute for Research in English Teaching, which was quite a large institute with Japanese professors on a board of directors and thousands of members who were teachers of English from all parts of the Japanese Empire, as it was in those days. So Palmer was engaged in all sorts of research. He started off with vocabulary selection and vocabulary control, went on to work on collocations. A collocation is a succession of words, the meaning of which you cannot identify from the words individually, one by one. You have to know the word as a group. For example, "in spite of" is a collocation, and so is "for example," I suppose. And he had a grant of money from the Ford Foundation for this purpose, and I was given the job of going through the Shorter English Dictionary, and I think the big Webster Dictionary, and two or three others, to comb out every possible collocation and put it onto record cards, which were then filed away in boxes. That started me off on something that's been happening ever since, putting things on cards and storing them away. So We then went on to syntax, finding out the patterns of sentences. And as many of you will know, I have used these patterns in my dictionaries, the form of verb patterns. Because if you're going to make the pattern of a sentence, you will find that the keystone of your arch is always the verb. It's the keystone which holds everything together. And if you don't get your verb right and the pattern for the verb right, well, the sentence just falls to pieces. So that was how I got involved in some of this question of grammar and pattern making, which has been a feature of my work since, especially in dictionaries and in the Guide to Patterns, which was published after I got back from Japan.
Were you actually a member of the Institute during that time?
I became a member of the Institute while I was in the south of Japan, because we had members all over the country. We had a little periodical came out every month. But when I got to Tokyo, I became a research worker for the Institute. That was the title they gave me, and as I said, I did a lot of work on collocations and verb patterns, things of that sort. And Palmer left Japan about 1933. And after his return to England, well, I more or less took his place. I didn't take his title. I didn't become director. But, in fact, I directed most of the work that was done by the research workers, a small group of British, American, and Japanese friends who worked together and did these things. And we turned out reports of various sorts for our annual meetings. Some of these reports are still in print. The report on vocabulary selection, report on verb patterns, report on an attempt at lexicography. These are the sort of thing we did, and which led to the use of this material in various kinds of book. We did language courses. We did, Palmer did one or two books which published by Longmans after his return. And, of course, my own dictionary done in Japan in the early stages, and later reprinted in this country by the Oxford University Press. All of this research work was helpful when I got to the work of compiling this dictionary with two or three friends.
When did you leave the Institute?
Well, of course, I left the Institute, if you can put it that way, when Pearl Harbor came. Pearl Harbor came and ended my work in Japan very abruptly. I had the idea that I might be in Japan until the end of the war, but the Department of Education, which had brought me to Japan and which had continued to employ me, came along and said very kindly, well, you've been here so long, everybody knows a lot of work you've done for Japan, so we'll let you go back when the ambassador goes, which was a great relief to me, of course. And I got away with my clothes, but with none of my books and papers. That was a misfortune. Luckily, when I did get back to England, Palmer was living there and was able to replace most of the things that I'd lost. He had copies of all this work we'd done in Japan and very kindly let me have them. And after his death, his widow gave me a lot more of Palmer's things, so I was, in the end, fairly well supplied with the work we had been done together.
And back in England, you joined the British Council, did you?
Yes. When I got back, a long voyage back via South Africa on a Red Cross ship, I found a message waiting for me at my home, where my parents were, saying that the British Council would very much like to have me as a linguistic advisor for the Middle East. And in Cairo, British Council wanted me to stay and be linguistic advisor for the whole of the Middle East area. But I had been appointed to Tehran, so in the end, I went through to Tehran, and during the rest of the war, I was teaching at the Teacher Training Institute of the University of Tehran, and part of the time I was acting director of the Anglo-Persian Institute in Tehran, where we taught, I suppose, thousands of students during those years. I had a great difficulty in finding teachers. We had a certain number of British Council teachers with us. They weren't enough. So I went to the British Army and said, look here, in the Army here, you must have a lot of people, conscript people, who were teachers in civil life. Can you lend me them in the evenings? So I got about 30 or 40 British Army men
and they came in the evenings, and I gave them a short intensive course in methodology, put them in charge of the classes, and used to go round and see that they were doing their stuff in the proper way. And they were very successful teachers in the end. And so we overcame that problem of how to get teachers of English in Tehran.
And then back to England.
Then, when the war in Europe ended, I returned to England. And the British Council in London asked me to be their linguistic advisor. So I asked the head of the English department whether I could start a new periodical. And he thought it might be a good idea. You see, we had a periodical in Japan for the Institute for Research in English Teaching. So I did something on similar lines called English Language Teaching. And that periodical has gone on very well since those early days. I think I edited it for about 3 years. And now, of course, it is edited by Dr. Lee and is published for the British Council by the Oxford University Press and is a much fatter and more useful periodical than it was in the early days.
And were you lecturing during this time for the British Council?
Yes. After about 3 or 4 years in London with the British Council, I thought I might like to get into the country because I'm really a country lover, not a city dweller. And one of the men at the Oxford Press, who had my dictionary on his list, suggested that I might like to work in the country and make smaller dictionaries from the bigger ones. And then I started to write 1 or 2 language courses. I did a language course for Iraq, and then a course for adult learners, progressive English for adult learners. And while I was doing that, for variety, I would occasionally do a long lecture tour overseas for the British Council. And for a period of about 6 or 7 years, I think, I went all over the Middle East 2 or 3 times. And then I went to Latin America. Then I did several long tours in India and Pakistan, Burma, and I've been back to Japan twice. And when those very long tours ended, I began to find very long tours rather tiring. I did shorter tours into Europe, Luxembourg, Belgium and Holland, Denmark, Germany. Not all the countries of Europe, but quite a number of them. Those much shorter tours, not quite so strenuous.
Did you notice any tremendous changes in Japan when you went back?
The changes in Japan when I went back were enormous. I did not go back, of course, immediately after the war, while Japan was still destroyed. It had been rebuilt entirely when I got back. And Tokyo was a completely different city. Modern highways, 3 or 4 different levels, speedways, enormous tower blocks of buildings everywhere. Greatly increased traffic. When I was there, Tokyo was comparatively quiet, but now, like any big modern capital city, it's noisy, and you have the smell of gasoline everywhere. I didn't like it quite so much as in the old days. The old days, it was a very pleasant city to be in. But still, it's very progressive, and the thing I enjoyed most, of course, was to meet all my old, friends, I could call them now. They were my students in the old days, but they were my friends then, but when I got back, 1959, at 2 visits, I found that these students of mine remembered me, and that was a very pleasant thing, to go back and find that you were remembered after all those years. And I was given all sorts of parties and different people who had been in different classes. And they were the most friendly people you could imagine. And, of course, I had known them as students in their late teens or early 20s. Now they were 20 years older, and I said, what are you doing now? And one would say, oh, I'm the president of the bank of so-and-so, or I'm managing this big company or that big company. And they're all very successful men. A lot of them were in big government positions. And I had the chance to speak to all my students who knew about my presence by radio. I went to Japan Tokyo Broadcasting Company's offices and it was announced that I was going to give a talk to anybody who had remembered me from my days in Japan. So students who couldn't get to Tokyo to meet me had the chance of hearing me talk. I also did a TV appearance too, but I don't know what happened to that. I've never been on TV before. I probably made a mess of it.
So after all this very extensive world travelling, Mr. Hornby, you came back to England and concentrated on writing.
Yes. Yes, I found that I had a lot of things that I thought I could put onto paper in the way of dictionaries and grammar books. After 30 years of experience, I don't think anybody could sit down and write textbooks, grammars, dictionaries for those who are studying English as a foreign language, unless that person had had long experience in the classroom. That is essential, I think. And I felt that I had had this long experience actually in the classroom. Then I'd been round the world and seen conditions in many parts of the world. I think I forgot to say I'd been to Africa two or three times, to East Africa, did long tours there. So that gave me what I felt was a solid background. Then there was the research that we'd done in Tokyo. So I felt I was qualified to put something down on paper. I wouldn't have dared to do that if I hadn't had that experience, but I had it. So I started to write the Guide to Patterns, which put down what I thought was useful to a foreign learner about grammar and usage. And then the decision came that a second edition of the big dictionary I'd done in Japan was useful. The first one was published in Japan just about the time of Pearl Harbor, just before. And I didn't actually see a bound copy until after the war. I had sent a complete set of proofs, sheets of proofs from Tokyo before Pearl Harbor, while the services were still going, to the OUP in London. And they were unable to print it in England until after the war because of, well, shortages of paper and all that sort of thing. But it did appear in London after the war.
What were the sort of features of this edition as opposed to the other English language dictionaries which were available at the time?
Well, you know, if you look at any ordinary dictionary published in this country or in the United States, for those who have English as a mother tongue, so much is assumed. We know that the Englishman or the American, Scotsman, he knows these words, and he will refer to the dictionary only for something that is out of the way or unusual. If he turns to a word like start, it will be because of some particular use that he is not quite certain of. But if you are thinking at, say, a Japanese student or a French student or a German student, he may not know when he can use start as an alternative for begin or vice versa. I can say, when's this bus going to start? It's very late. I can't say when's this bus going to begin, can I? That's not English. Well, all those little things I was aware of simply because I had taught English overseas for such a long period. I knew that certain words in English, short, simple words, have next to no meaning. If you ask me what the word on means, well, I'd have to write an essay to describe it fully and give you hundreds of examples. And if you ask what the word THE means, it's another problem. Those are what we call structural words. They're like the bricks with which you build. But it is the structural words that are the key to the language, and unless you know how to use the structural words, you can't start to build sentences. So I decided in the dictionary to pay particular attention to these structural words. For example, these little adverbs of prepositions like on, up, away, about, in, up, down. Now, why are they important? The meaning is fairly easy to grasp. But when they combine with verbs, they have certain idiosyncrasies. You can say, put your hat on. Or you can say, put on your hat. You can say, take off your coat. You can say, take your coat off. If instead of saying coat, you say it, what do you do? You say, take it off. You can't say, take off it. You can say, put it on, but you can't say, put on it. So, you see, these little words, we call them adverbial particles, precede the object, if it is a noun, or they can follow it if it is a noun. And so that's just an example of many, many things that can be given in a dictionary for the student of English who is not English, who is a foreigner. And that's the kind of thing I provide in the dictionary.
As sort of example sentences to illustrate the meanings.
Yes. And so after having dealt with this sort of thing briefly in the definition, the key to the dictionary is the examples. We give a very large number of examples. The same with verb patterns. You take a verb like give, you can say, give me that book, please. Me precedes the direct object. Now, suppose instead of me, you use a long phrase. The girl sitting in the corner, or the girl sitting by the window. What would you say? Give the girl sitting by the window that book? No, that would be wrong. Not wrong, but it wouldn't sound right. You say, oh, give that book to the girl sitting in the corner. You change the pattern. And so in the verb patterns, you have both given. Give somebody something and give something to somebody. And then you have illustrations to show that when the indirect object is short, you say, give somebody something. And when it is long, you say, give something to somebody. Well, when we get to the dictionary entry itself, the patterns are given by a reference to numbered verb patterns, and then you have examples which illustrate the two patterns clearly, at least I hope they do. And we have throughout paid great attention to the verb patterns by means of illustrative phrases and sentences. The first edition, I was helped by Professor Gatenby and Mr. Wakefield, who were friends of mine. The second edition, I had to do most of that myself because Mr. Wakefield and Mr. Gatenby were dead. So I spent, I think, 2 or 3 years for the second edition, and I decided to bring it up to date because of the passage of time. A great many new words had come into the language. And then I found that the dictionary, which I had originally thought of as chiefly for Asia, was now being sold in many parts of the world. And so I had to take into consideration the vocabulary needs and interests of students in Europe and Africa and other countries, as well as those in Asia. And those in Europe especially, of course, had much wider interests because of Western cultural influences.
Were there any other particular characteristics of that first edition of the Advanced Learners which you subsequently modified or changed for the later editions?
Well, I think in the first edition I've talked about the grammar features, especially the verb patterns. There was also, of course, the use of symbols for countable and uncountable nouns, which has been retained in all three editions because it is so important in many parts of the world. We are accustomed to plural and singular. We talk a book, singular, some books, plural. But in many languages, Japanese especially, there's no difference between singular and plural. We use the word furniture, which is always singular, poetry always singular, news always singular, although it looks plural. In other languages, those words may have a plural ending. They may be used in the plural. Japanese, we have singular only, and so the Japanese tend to use a singular word when they're beginning for either plural or singular. So I use the symbols C and U, countable and uncountable, to indicate that a noun could be used in the plural. If you have a word like cup, well, it can be cups, so that would be marked C. If you have a word like water or coffee, that would be marked U because it is uncountable. You can't say two waters or two coffees. But, of course, one would always qualify that somewhere in the definition by saying you can say two coffees, meaning two cups of coffee and things of that sort. That's where you have trouble with any strict rules.
How did you compile the vocabulary content of the advanced learners from those early days?
Well, of course, we had our own vocabulary selections, but that was just about 3,000 words for compiling language courses. They were obvious choices, and any dictionary must have those. For the rest, I'm afraid it was a matter of just my own judgment or the judgment of friends whom I consulted. We felt that we didn't want to put in too many technical words. for example, terms from medicine and surgery, because I feel any student who's going to be a doctor or a surgeon will learn those words from his own textbooks. And we felt they were specialized items, and rightly or wrongly, we didn't put them into the first edition. We concentrated upon a general purpose vocabulary intended to cover what was called current English or modern English. And modern English means English as you might expect to find it in periodicals and books, not technical ones, but ordinary books, fiction, drama, from the time of Shakespeare onwards. Not necessarily covering all the words in Shakespeare that are now obsolete or difficult, but anything after that time. And we did occasionally say that a word was obsolescent, if we didn't want it to be used today, to avoid that sort of thing. But on the whole, it was a general purpose vocabulary.
And I imagine from your contacts throughout the world that you've been enjoying a wide correspondence with people who've used the dictionary and have commented to you on it.
Yes, I've had correspondence from many parts of the world ever since I first started on lexicography. And I've been very grateful to most of them.
This latest edition of the dictionary seems to be a very thorough revision and redesigning of the material.
That is true. I think we started this about 3 years ago. Probably took about 2 years to put into shape, and another year for production, perhaps. So I think you'll realize that there has been a big revolution in language during recent years. We often hear about the population explosion, but there's been another explosion, that is the explosion in the demand for English. The whole world has, during recent years, been filled with demands for English teaching, and it's been very difficult to meet the demand for teachers. You know that with the development of technology in recent years, men walking on the moon, rockets going round the earth, new developments in every kind of science, computers, all these things, it has increased our awareness of the vocabulary needed for these things. In the old days, we didn't need words connected with these very advanced technologies. But today, that is not true. We do need to know something of the vocabulary used by space technicians. We need to know what a module is. When the lunar module is detached to go to the moon, we want to know what a module is. I didn't know the word when I was a boy of 14. I'm not sure that I know everything about it now, because I see it in all sorts of contexts. And then there was another explosion, and that is the explosion I call the demand for vernacular English. People today travel much more than they used to do. This country is full of European students in the summer, come over here in droves. And our students go to Europe. There's an exchange, a cultural exchange, all sorts of exchanges nowadays. And so spoken English has become much more important than it was when I wrote the first edition. People are more and more interested in the spoken language. They hear our programs on radio. They see our films. Their TV programs made in this country are shown all over the world. And that's all a different kind of English. It's spoken English, not formal written English. So I had to pay much more attention to what we might call the vernacular, to conversational styles. And that meant bringing in some things like slang uses, which I had not paid much attention to in the first edition. And so we did pay attention to these, and when it came to words that are not quite proper, well, we put them in, but we gave all sorts of warnings so that the innocent young student from Europe would not find himself causing consternation by using them in the wrong place to the wrong people.
And then, of course, there's the enormous influence of American English.
Yes. If you go to Europe today, you find that students of English want to know British English, British pronunciation, but they also want to be familiar with American pronunciation and American variants and meanings. So, again, I noted during my reading and my listening the various American words that were commonly used. I consulted American dictionaries, and we've given a very representative selection of American vocabulary. And in the pronunciation, we have added American variants wherever necessary.
For this latest edition, Mr. Hornby, you had the opportunity of the help from a number of specialist people in the English language teaching field.
Yes, I was very glad to have help from several people on certain aspects of the dictionary. I had very great help from Mr. Carey at the University of Leeds, the Department of English. He has been working on verbs, what he used to call phrasal verbs, for many, many years. Well, that means a verb which is used with a preposition or an adverb. Come in. There you have come, the adverb in. And he was not only familiar with every possible combination of verb and adverb or preposition, but was able to use my verb patterns and set them out very clearly by arranging them in alphabetical order with these phrases set out in bold type so that you can look through the entry for come and very quickly find the one you're looking for and get the pattern and illustrative phrases or sentences for that pattern. It was something specially done for me by Mr. Carey, and I'm very grateful to him for all that work he did so very thoroughly. Now, this phonetic transcription, that was a very important thing for all dictionaries, and we used, for the first edition and the second edition, the system of symbols used by Daniel Jones in his English Pronouncing Dictionary. We chose that because at that time it was used all over the world for the teaching of English, but we're not using it in the third edition. I had the help of an expert phonetician who is at the University of Leeds, and he was able to give me an updated system for showing phonetic symbols for British and American pronunciation. It is a new transcription which Winsor Lewis has specially designed with the advice and approval, I think, of Professor Gimson, who succeeded Daniel Jones at University College, and is what he thinks the most suitable transcription for the learner of English as a foreign language. That means it is ideally designed for you who are listening to me now. You are told how each symbol is pronounced in both British and American styles, so that you can get a transcription which will help you to pronounce the word as it should be pronounced once you get to know the symbols. And you'll find these symbols set out for very easy and quick reference on the end papers of the dictionary. That is, you open the dictionary at either end, and there they are set out for you to see quickly.
The new edition of the dictionary contains a very extensive introduction.
Yes, there is a long introduction to the new edition of the dictionary, and I have a suspicion that a lot of people never read introductions. I very seldom do myself when I pick up a book. But I would suggest that this introduction is worth a few hours' careful study, because it will help you to use the dictionary efficiently if you can find time to look at it. It tells you, for example, about word division. And I know you're always having problems. How shall I divide this word, if at all? Well, if you get a single syllable like THAT, that you know you don't divide it. I have seen it done in some essays I've had, but you wouldn't do that, of course. But when you come to a word of more than one syllable, you think, oh, well, now we can divide that at the end of a line or the beginning of a line. And you say, well, now here's a word like above. Can I put A hyphen and B-O-V-O in the next line? Well, most dictionaries give a hyphen after A and say it has two syllables. It is. But as an example of the advice given in this introductory matter, we say don't divide a word if one syllable is one letter only. Theoretically it is possible, but in practice avoid doing it. Then there's a long section on the verb patterns, which, if you study that and memorize the patterns, or try to memorize them gradually as you use a dictionary, that will give you a great help in constructing sentences. The 25 verb patterns are set out there, slightly different from those in the first and second editions. And that renumbering may give a little confusion if you're used to the old numbers. But I've tried to make it more logical. I've put all the intransitive uses first, and then the transitive uses of a verb later. And very difficult indeed, but I try to arrange them so that the commonest patterns come first and the rarest verb patterns come last. That is not an adequate explanation of the whole renumbering and rearrangement, but I can't go into that now. But I hope you will find that that section on verb patterns will help you. There's a long section on what we call stylistic values, which is worth reading and giving as much time as possible to, because one of the most difficult things for the learner of English is to know whether a word is something he can use in ordinary casual conversation, or whether it's formal, or whether it's out of date or slang. And so in that little section on stylistic values, there's some advice. If you use a word that is out of date, well, people will probably understand you, but they will think, oh, his English is a bit not quite right yet. He's still got to learn about slang. And then lots of slang words which are not to be used at all. You will hear them. You hear them on TV and radio and cinema, but if you use them yourself, you'd probably shock people, consternation. So take warning from this little chapter on stylistic values, and you will save yourself a lot of trouble, I hope.
And finally, at the back of the book, there are numerous appendices.
Yes, we had a lot of appendices in the first edition and the second edition. In the new edition, these have been brought up to date. Of course, when it comes to abbreviations, they're always being invented. They get new abbreviations every day, don't we? And so we put in all those that we think are useful. There's a new appendix on numbers. And that is, I think, something that you really will find useful. How do you speak when you are giving a telephone number? You say 2255? No, 2255. But if it's 2556, you don't say 2556. You arrange them in pairs from the beginning or from the end, but you don't arrange a pair in the middle. Well, that's very complicated, and you will find full instructions on how to read numbers for not only telephone numbers, but for games, the kind of numbers we use keeping scores at tennis, football, all these things. And then there are tables to show measures and weights. And we not only give the traditional systems that are used in England for weights and measures and lengths and so on, we also give the newer systems. We compare our old systems with the new metric systems, which are being adopted now. We have the old system of British money, pounds, shillings and pence, and then the newer metric system. We have affixes. That means, of course, suffixes and prefixes. And, well, if you know what some of these mean, then you can easily get the meaning of a word which is perhaps not entered in the dictionary itself.
One of the dramatic changes in the new edition over the other ones, Mr. Hornby, is the use of illustration and the kind of illustration which is now in the book.
Yes, I think you will enjoy very much turning the pages of the dictionary over and just looking at the illustrations. They're very, very good indeed, many of them. The photographs have been very, very well produced indeed. And where drawings are concerned, they're very often grouped so that instead of having pictures of, say, birds scattered throughout the book at the entry for the names of the birds, you have them all together, or perhaps in two or three groups, where they can be compared in size and general appearance. And a lot of diagrams are useful, too.
And there seems to be an extensive use of labelling within these.
Yes, a lot of cross-references. When you come to various items in the dictionary, you will see a little arrow, and that will tell you see the illustration at so-and-so.
The actual text of the dictionary seems to be so much more legible and clear than the former editions. Was this due to any particular difference in production technique from the two earlier editions?
Well, you see, I think a note somewhere saying that the setting was done with the help of computer experts, and we had these large printouts, which meant the proofreading was easy, and these printouts were in the size of ordinary typewriting, so that that was very much easier to read. And then when these printouts were corrected, right up to the final stages almost, then it was passed on to the computer at the Oxford Press and put on to magnetic tape, which means that we can at any time revise and update what we have said. And that will be a great advantage, of course. Instead of having to wait for a new edition, we can do things any time we like.
I imagine you're preparing work for a next edition now, Mr. Hornby.
Well, yes, I often think that I should stop working and retire, but I've been in the habit of working all my life, and I don't suppose I shall ever stop. And even since I finished work on this third edition, I continue to hear and see things, make a note on a sheet of paper or a card and drop it into a box ready for the fourth edition, which I hope I shall live to see completed and out.
So do we. Thank you very much, Mr. Hornby.